Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural, and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Thanks for coming along tonight. Look, it's great to have Dr. Charlesworth here today. I'll introduce her very briefly. As you know, a while ago, a few months ago, we had John Hastisagos, the New South Wales Attorney General, talking on the Bill of Rights, and we thought we'd ask Professor Hilary Charlesworth here tonight. Introduce her very briefly. Educated at Melbourne University, Harvard University, well-known commentator, author, but currently Professor of International Law and Human Rights in the Faculty of Law at the Australian National University in Canberra, and a Director of the Centre for International Governance and Justice, also at the ANU. And Professor Charlesworth is going to talk tonight on democratic objections to bills of rights. Hilary Charlesworth, you're very welcome.
Thanks very much, Derek. I'm really delighted to be here at the Sydney Institute. I've always wondered what it would look like, and now I know. And I'd like to thank Jared very much for his gracious invitation. The Sydney Institute has long been an influential participant in the Australian debate about bills of rights. And Jared, of course, himself has written on this topic. And there have been, I've noticed over the years, a number of prominent speakers on this issue, most recently the New South Wales Attorney General. The issue of a national bill of rights has come onto the national agenda with the commitment of the Rudd government to engage in a community consultation on whether or not there should be an Australian bill or charter of rights. So that was contained in the Labor Party's platform when they went to an election last year, and that commitment has been confirmed by both the Attorney General Robert McClellan and by the Prime Minister more recently. Now, I should make it clear at the beginning that I'm using the term Bill of Rights tonight to mean a statutory Bill of Rights along the lines of the United Kingdom Human Rights Act or the ACT or Victorian Bills of Rights, and I'll describe a bit more about them in contrast to a constitutional Bill of Rights. In questions, I'm very happy to discuss views on constitutional Bills of Rights, but when I speak about Bills of Rights tonight, that's what I'm referring to. I think it's fair to say, I think Jared would agree with me, that the Institute has been associated with the negative case for any type of Bill of Rights, and so I really welcome this opportunity to present a different perspective. I think overall, arguments against bills of rights fall into three rather general related categories. One is it ain't broke, so we don't need to fix it. Australia is a gold-plated democracy. We often hear those words. So that's one form of criticism of the move to have a Bill of Rights. Secondly, there's another strand of criticism. I think Bob Carr is the exponent par excellence of this, is that it will just encourage a lawyer's picnic, the idea that really lawyers, of course, are interested in these things because they're going to directly benefit from the a great wave of litigation. And the third argument is that a Bill of Rights is really, it would be inimical to Australia's democracy. And I'm planning tonight to focus on that third argument because I think it's the most durable and the most important and the toughest one. So in a nutshell, this argument, the democratic objection to Bills of Rights, is that Bills of Rights are antithetical both to Australian democracy and to the proper judicial role because they limit legislative power and effectively transfer power from the elected legislators to an unelected judiciary. This transfer of power is, of course, most obvious in the case of a constitutional Bill of Rights, where legislation can actually be struck down or invalidated if interpreted to be inconsistent with protected rights, so such as we see in the United States Bill of Rights, for example. But this illegitimate transfer of power is also increasingly feared in the case of legislative or statutory bills of rights, such as those of the United Kingdom, New Zealand, the ACT, and Victoria. So So the idea, I take it, of the critics is that parliamentary sovereignty and the tradition of responsible government in Australia, the convention that the executive branch of government is kept in check by being answerable to the elected legislature, that these mechanisms are perfectly adequate to protect individual rights. And so this type of argument has been made in different ways, but still fairly consistently, by eminent judges and politicians really over the last 60 years, from Sir Owen Dixon of the High Court through to Sir Harry Gibbs, another Chief Justice, to Robert Menzies, John Howard, and John But I think I'm going to take as my text actually a statement of this argument by Bob Carr in 2001, who's also very, very much associated with this view. And this is going to be my text for the evening. Let me read you what he said in 2001. Parliaments, he said, are elected to make laws. In doing so, they make judgments about how the rights and interests of the public should be balanced. Views will differ in any given case about whether the judgment is correct. However, if the decision is unacceptable, the community can make its views known at regular elections. This, he said, is our political tradition. But, by contrast, a Bill of Rights would pose a fundamental shift in this tradition, with the Parliament abdicating its important policy-making functions to the judiciary. The Bill of Rights, wrote Bob Carr, is an admission of the failure of parliaments, governments and the people to behave in a reasonable, responsible and respectful manner. I do not believe we have failed. So I just take that as a quite a pithy and elegant statement of the democratic objection to Bills of Rights. Now, this idea that parliaments are the only proper forums for the protection of rights, and that if we let judges loose with rights, they might get carried away and impose their own political, moral and ethical views on the interpretation of the law, and so undermining the democratic process. This argument, I think, has powerful rhetorical appeal. The criticism typically emphasises the fact that judges are unelected, implying that the process of standing for election provides proper accountability for action. But against this popular critique, my claim is that a Bill of Rights is not only no threat to Australian democracy, but in fact it's likely to enhance democratic governance in Australia. Now, to support this argument, I want to avoid the broad generalisations and sometimes, I might say, wild exaggerations that often characterise the debate in Australia, and instead draw on the actual evidence we now have about the way that statutory bills of rights operate in the United Kingdom, the ACT and Victoria. So I want to do this by pointing to three reasons why the democratic objection to bills of rights doesn't fit with the evidence that we have. So first of all, I think we need to consider how well elected governments, like our own, how well they in fact protect human rights, and whether, as Bob Carr implies, governments that breach human rights will suffer in elections, will be held accountable at elections. In practice, the human rights dimensions of political issues are not regularly discussed in Australian parliaments, and the major political parties are regularly in agreement on the groups whose freedoms need to be restricted. You only have to follow a bit of parliamentary dialogue about human rights to see how limited and impoverished it is. Political debate is governed by party allegiance by and large, and attempts by individual politicians to pursue human rights issues are typically muzzled. So I think that the claim of Bob Carr, and John Howard used to make the same claim too, that robust parliamentary debate operates to protect rights, that actually has very little empirical basis in Australian history. Just to give a couple of examples, the passage of the 2005 Commonwealth Terrorism legislation is an example, I think, of major policy measures with implications for human rights being devised in secret by the executive. You might recall the tremendous furore when the Chief Minister of the ACT actually revealed a draft bill on his website. And you just have to watch the legislative debate in that context to see that it was really pushed through without serious debate. And the Labor Party, by and large, agreed very much with what the coalition government was doing. Another example are earlier laws, laws first adopted in 1992 by the Keating government, which were then confirmed by the coalition government, that provided for the mandatory detention of asylum seekers, including children in Australia. And you just have to go back and look at some of the debates surrounding the time when those laws were introduced to see there was really no attention given to the human rights implications of those, I think, truly shocking laws. Now, there's little in our constitution that restrains Commonwealth legislative power to breach human rights, a point that was acknowledged explicitly by members of the High Court in some recent decisions, most notably the Alcatraz case, where the High Court simply acknowledged, well, we simply don't have the power to deal with laws that might breach human rights. We simply have to look whether a particular law is within a grant of legislative power. That's the only question in town. So I think because of this, because of our limited constitutional remit, it's possible for our elected representatives to breach human rights without effective scrutiny of any type by the judiciary, by the media, or by the community. And minorities are most at risk of human rights breaches. And for this reason, I think, legislatures are unlikely to be held accountable for human rights violations at the ballot box. Now, my argument isn't that parliaments are somehow inherently less suited than courts to make human rights decisions, but it's rather that, at least in Australia, they're currently much less likely to do so. In my view, a Bill of Rights provides a framework of principles that brings human rights issues onto the political agenda in a systematic way and makes these principles part of the political calculus. The United Kingdom, the ACT, and the Victorian Bill of Rights all allow parliaments to override human rights guarantees when they consider it necessary to do so. But these type of statutory bills of rights mean that the overriding of human rights has to be explicit and therefore subject to public scrutiny. So in this sense, I would argue, contrary to Bob Carr, that a Bill of Rights is not, to use his words, an admission of the failure of parliaments, governments and the people to behave in a reasonable, responsible and respectful manner. But rather, I'd suggest, they're a mechanism to encourage and support parliaments and governments in doing this. Now, it's very easy, of course, to point to governments with much, much worse human rights records than Australia. And I note that Cardinal Pell, in a recent talk on Bills of Rights for the Brisbane Institute, pointed to Pakistan and Zimbabwe and said, well, look, those are countries we should be getting worked up about. Here in Australia, basically everything is pretty okay. Now, in fact, of course, one can easily concede that the human rights situations in those countries is much, much more dire than in Australia. But it seems to me that they're not very useful comparisons. I don't think we have to say, so we're better than Pakistan and Zimbabwe, so we should rest easy. They're simply not useful comparators. And I think even though generally, of course, Australia has a fairly good human rights record, I think we should be aiming much higher. We have some very clear human rights blots on our record. So my point is that legislatures in Australia could benefit from being required to think through in a systematic way the human rights consequences of their actions. So that's my first sort of point of argument. My second one, the second reason why I think the anti-democratic criticism of bills of rights is difficult to sustain is because it really depends on a caricature of the judicial role. Now, critics of bills of rights often present striking and unattractive images of judges. And you only had to read my colleague Jim Allen's article in The Australian last week to get a flavour of that type of mood. So the implication is that a Bill of Rights will operate to seduce the judiciary into seizing more power. Or, to take Bob Carr's words again, that a Bill of Rights will force Parliament into abdicating its important policy-making functions to the judiciary. Along these lines, a more fundamental claim made by critics of Bills of Rights is that decisions on human rights will inevitably take judges out of the legal realm into a moral minefield. The argument is that judicial decisions about human rights are qualitatively different from any other type of judicial decision. So there is an implication in these moves that judges are somehow constrained when they're dealing with the interpretation of laws generally, but in the area of human rights, they're given a carte blanche to go wild. However, I think that this is a contention that seriously misrepresents the role of judges. If you think about most parliaments in Australia, there are constant calls, the laws that they adopt constantly call on the judiciary to make difficult calls of interpretation. Now, this, of course, is most obvious in the area of constitutional law. Our constitution is very broad. What does absolutely free mean in Section 92 and so on? But you only have to pick up any statute to note that our laws are full of terms such as reasonable or adequate, unduly, relevant, unfairly, best interests of the child, all terms which require significant context and judicial development. We also have in Australia, you know, a phenomenon, quite a tradition of judicial dissents, which is evidence that there's often not one clear, easy answer to how the law applies in particular contexts, and the judicial minds will often differ. So when people like Jim Allen argue that, and this is a quote from one of his pieces, if Australia opts for a Bill of Rights, then the judges will end up deciding controversial questions of social policy over which sincere, intelligent, well-meaning people disagree. My response to that point would be that the interpretation of human rights guarantees is no different in character to the accepted judicial role in statutory interpretation or the development of common law. So we just have to think about recent controversial decisions that judges have made on questions of social policy. Take, for example, in the last decade, the High Court's decisions on Indigenous land rights, or their decisions on wrongful life actions, or you just have to take federal court decisions on the interpretation of legislation such as the Trade Practices Act, or the Family Court's decision on the Family Law Act. Now, many times decisions from the courts provoke great debate, but they don't lead to calls to remove the judiciary from involvement in the interpretation of common law or the statutes. So it seems to me that rights critics do not explain why such decisions are qualitatively different to those relating to human rights provisions. And why, I think to be logical, if one is critical of judges making decisions in interpretation, to be logical, there should be a general call for the election of judges to ensure that the judiciary is directly accountable to the people in all legal contexts. I think we often forget that we leave our judges with many significant roles that we simply accept. So critics of bills of rights, it seems to me, also assume that rights, unlike other legal provisions, are empty shells that can be filled with content in an arbitrary way. However, the assumption that human rights guarantees can be interpreted according to judicial whim or the roll of the dice isn't based on any understanding of judicial practice over the last 50 or 60 years. So if you follow the judgments, for example, of the European Court of Human Rights, which has been operating since the early 1950s, or the UN Human Rights Committees, or if you look at more recent systems of jurisprudence from national courts, such as those from the New Zealand courts or the United Kingdom courts, we can see the jurisprudence that has emerged has really developed principles that guide and constrain judicial interpretation of rights, so that the judicial role in human rights interpretation is really, I would argue, no different to the interpretation of other statutes. And I'm happy in the question time to give examples of that. But let me move on to my third, I suppose, counterpoint to the democratic objection to bills of rights. And this is that the democratic objection to bills of rights has really been developed in relation to constitutional bills of rights that allow the judiciary to invalidate legislation. And in my view, it doesn't readily translate to the context of legislative or statutory bills of rights. Now, for a start, the New Zealand, the UK, ACT, Victoria, all there, the bills of rights can be readily repealed. They're just ordinary statutes of Parliament. And to me, it's difficult to see how these laws can be characterised as anti-democratic because they have been freely adopted by the elected representatives of the people and can be equally freely amended or repealed. Now, these modern bills of rights, as I'll term them, don't allow the judiciary to strike down legislation as invalid if it's inconsistent with human rights. Rather, they depend on what's been called a dialogue model of human rights protection, which could be just explained slightly less glamorously as encouraging institutional interaction on human rights issues. So the idea is that you have a human rights dialogue and the participants are the three arms of government, the legislature, the executive and judiciary, and the community. How is this dialogue achieved? Well, all these bills of rights that I've referred to have a requirement, first of all, that all laws should be interpreted to be consistent with human rights as far as possible, as far as the language will allow. If a human rights consistent interpretation isn't possible, these modern bills of rights allow the judiciary to issue a formal declaration that the law is inconsistent with human rights. Now, this declaration by the judiciary doesn't affect the validity of the law, but requires the legislature to consider the inconsistency and make a judgment on how to proceed. These statutory bills of rights also allow actions against public authorities for breaches of human rights, but at least in the case of the ACT in Victoria, no damages can be awarded, no monetary damages can be awarded for breaches of human rights by public authorities. Now, it's important to note that the dialogue contemplated by these dialogue model bills of rights isn't an open-ended dialogue that can go on forever. Because after debate, after human rights, possible human rights breaches have been brought to the attention of the legislature, the final word on human rights protection remains with the legislature. So it may be, in particular circumstances, that a government will decide that it will enact a law that will result in a breach of human rights. But the statutory bills of rights require that a government should only do so when they've considered all the issues and when they've justified publicly the human rights breach. So the idea, at least, is the theory that this is a way to create a durable human rights culture within government and the community, rather than leaving, as in the American Bill of Rights, if you like, a judicial monologue on the content of human rights. But the judiciary, of course, in the ACT or Victorian model of Bill of Rights is an important participant in the rights conversation because the judiciary has to, in particular cases, confront specific claims of rights violations in a way that the government doesn't have to when it's adopting general laws. So, as I've said, the overall effect of these modern bills of rights is to require a government to think through the human rights implications of proposed actions. Well, what's actually happened? This sounds all very well in theory, but has this actually happened in practice? I just want to mention briefly what's happened in the ACT where I live. So our Human Rights Act has now been in force for just over 4 years, and it's very interesting to see its effect. It's had quite a profound effect, particularly on the executive government and the legislature. And a variety of government policy proposals have been redesigned, and some of them have actually been jettisoned on human rights grounds. One example of how this has affected the drafting of legislation, for example, is the 2006 ACT anti-terrorism law, which was adopted as part of the federal agreement to mirror the Commonwealth 2005 terrorism laws that I referred to earlier. If you look at the ACT one, it looks quite different to the other states and territories and the Commonwealth because it provides more legal safeguards than those laws do. For example, unlike the other laws, it allows judicial oversight of preventive detention orders, it excludes children from the preventive detention regime, and it omits the Commonwealth law's draconian penalties for simply disclosing the fact that you've been detained. Another example of the effect of the Human Rights Act in the ACT is actually happening at the moment. There's a piece of legislation, the Children and Young People Bill, which is going through our Legislative Assembly. And it's been very interesting watching those debates where, for example, you see both sides of politics raising the human rights of issues that I don't think would have been raised 5 years ago. For example, what are the human rights implications of strip searching of detained children? And there's been a very interesting debate on those issues. What's striking in the ACT, at least, is our Human Rights Act has had very little effect in the courts. So the action has been mainly in the executive and the legislature. It's been raised in a few court cases, but I have, and in about 60 cases it's been raised, but it actually hasn't affected the result, as far as I can see, in any of those cases. It's been used as an adjunct in arguments. So the effect has been, in the ACT, very much on the executive and the legislature. So some rights sceptics, of course, see legislative bills of rights as almost as pernicious as constitutional bills of rights. But I think that there really is a distinction between what has been called the strong judicial review required by a constitutional bill of rights and the less strong judicial review available under a statutory human rights scheme. So, in conclusion, what I've argued that is in Australia's political system, as it's now running at the national level, a statutory Bill of Rights, I think, would be likely to improve the quality of our democracy by requiring human rights standards to be taken into account in designing governmental actions and policy. Now, it will not, of course, be a panacea for all rights violations, but I think it will be likely to make the violations more obvious and subject to scrutiny. To borrow the words of Andrew Lynch at the University of New South Wales, a Bill of Rights compels politicians and government officials to lift their game by making them squarely consider the impact of proposed policies and laws on human rights. In this sense, and again borrowing Andrew Lynch's words, Bills of Rights promote political accountability and respect for the people beyond their role at the ballot box every few years. Let me just give you some real-life examples of the difference a statutory Bill of Rights has made outside courtrooms. And there's some very interesting publications and studies now of the effect of the United Kingdom Human Rights Act, which has been in force since the year 2000. One example is the case of a woman with a disability who was confined to a bed in the United Kingdom, and she required a special bed so that her carers could lift her for bathing. And she was still at home, and she requested that she be provided with this special bed, a double bed, so that her husband could share it. But this request was denied, even though she offered to pay any extra costs. And she battled sort of with the local authority who was responsible for that for 18 months. And in the end, eventually invoked her right to privacy and family life under the UK Human Rights Act in correspondence. And this led immediately to a change in policy. We see a similar example in the ACT, that some rather just standard general human policies on housing, public housing allocation, that take very little account of individual circumstances have been amended because of the Human Rights Act to cope with particular situations. Another example, and I think there was a similar one I noticed on the television news a few weeks ago, another case in the United Kingdom was a couple who'd been married for 65 years, I think, were separated at the time when the husband was admitted to a residential care home, and the wife was told, well, you can't go into that particular home because you don't fit the health criteria to actually live with him. And again, in that case, human rights arguments were used, again, the same right, the right to family life, to allow the wife to actually live with the husband. So the evidence that we have, particularly in the United Kingdom and the ACT, is that bills of rights are really useful in challenging the rigid application of blanket policies in ways that ignore real human lives. What's important to remember is that human rights can be a significant tool for people who face discrimination and disadvantage. They offer a vocabulary that can help bring cases of unfairness to the attention of decision makers that's quite distinct from existing administrative or discrimination law remedies. So the heart of the case against bills of rights, as I've described this evening, is that they're an assault on democracy. The claim is that Parliament is the only proper location for human rights conversations. And it seems to me that that argument reflects the power of the ideology of utilitarianism in Australian public life. This is a feature of Australian public life pointed out actually a long time ago by the political scientist Hugh Collins. So, of course, for a utilitarian, the aim of political society is the achievement of the greatest happiness of the greatest number. And utilitarian philosophers typically reject the idea of individuals as bearers of rights because this implies that individual or minority interests may on occasion take precedence over those of the majority. So essentially, the democratic objections to bills of rights, I think, is a utilitarian one. It understands democracy as essentially majority rule, and I think that's implicit in Bob Carr's statement with which I began. But to me, a real weakness of this approach is that it isn't interested in cases where majoritarian democracy delivers injustice, when the interests of a minority are not taken into account. Cases that may not directly impinge on the community understood as the majority, and really which are very unlikely to create a political backlash. So I want to leave you with the argument that the notion of democracy in Australia really has a much broader context and potential. And I would argue that we should really understand human rights and democracy as having a symbiotic relationship rather than the antagonistic relationship assumed by Australian Bill of Rights critics. So on this analysis, I'd argue that democracy depends on the protection of human rights, but at the same time, the protection of human rights depends on democracy. And my argument tonight has been that a Bill of Rights can help us achieve that.
Many thanks, Professor Charlesworth. It's always great when an academic turns up to speak for 30 minutes and speaks for 30 minutes and not 50 minutes or 45 minutes, which academics tend to do, so that's great. Before we go to question discussion, I should just say thanks to CAUSE for the use of this facility this evening, and so we come to questions and discussion. Those familiar with what we do here will finish no later than 7, maybe a bit before. So I'll just get our speaker to come up here. Can I just start off by talking about, you mentioned the ACT and its emphasis, I guess, of all the governments in Australia is most focused on human rights. And you mentioned, when you looked at Britain, you mentioned real-life examples. But as someone who's interested in real-life examples out of Canberra, there is a fixation on human rights, but I note there hasn't been a conviction for murder for 10 years, although there have been some very bad killings in Canberra. These have either been overturned by jury decisions, by judges, either result of a jury decision, by judges determining outcomes, or by appeal courts overturning jury decisions. How do we explain this attitude in Canberra where, however serious crimes seem to be, no one ever seems to be convicted of murder, including the case of some person who stabbed another person 57 times but was found not to have the requisite intention of killing.
Yeah, well, you sound like the Canberra Times who is making this point. I just say I have no... seems a perfectly peaceable place for me, but I have no insight on that. I would say, though, that in those cases, and I think the 57x7 that Shoggy case was the son of the mother, is that the one? Yes, it's sort of a really... terrible case, and let me just say that none of those cases, as far as I'm aware, were based on human rights grounds. So I think that if you see that as a problem, and many people do, let me just say that it's not an issue that is caused by human rights arguments at all. I think that one issue that's come up, this is just sort of local, what's been said, there has been quite a bit of criticism recently in the press, I have no idea how justified it is, of the office of the DPP in the preparation of cases. And I don't know if you're aware of some of the, there was a recent case where a prosecution actually had to be dropped completely because of the very... the problematic way that that it had been put together. But I have no particular insights into that issue, but I would suggest I think that that's quite a distinct issue from the Human Rights Act, and I don't think those are based on human rights type arguments.
I am aware of all this. I often say, I'm going to murder Anne, I'm going to move first to Canberra. It's the only place to be.
I might follow.
Very wise.
Yeah. Yes, thank you.
If you just speak down the end of the room. Yeah.
Okay.
Professor Charlesworth, thank you for a very interesting address. I certainly agree that the only prospect of getting any Bill of Rights protection would be through a statutory Bill of Rights and not a constitutional amendment. That would be impossible from a political point of view. But my question is this. You referred throughout your address to, you used the expression human rights, as a generic term, apparently encompassing all rights within that basket. but it's very important that there would be some definition of what human rights are, at least on a category basis. That still leaves enough room for a vast amount of room for interpretation. But are you assuming that the human rights will be those that are described in the, I forget whether it's Helsinki or Stockholm Convention on Human Rights, one of the Nordic countries, or is there some other description of them? Because that is very crucial to any human rights legislation. There are many people out there in the community who will be jumping in and saying, we want our rights protected. I want my right to stab my mother 47 times protected and not be guilty of murder. You know, there's so many groups out there. Anyway, I won't rave on. That's my question. How would you define it?
Okay, I precisely to keep within my sternly allocated time, I didn't give you my 30 minutes on human rights, and you're quite, thank you for pulling me up on that. I guess I was using the term human rights in the same way that the, I'm calling them these modern bills of rights do, UK, New Zealand, ACT, and they are essentially the rights set out in the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights. So they include the right to freedom of speech, the right to life, the right to privacy, the right to family life, the right to non-discrimination, the right to be free from torture, and so on. There is a separate debate and controversy about whether that is too narrow a set of rights, and that's been raised, should we include economic, social, and cultural rights, such as the right to health, and so on. But when I referred to human rights, I was really meaning the category that is, I guess, acknowledged in international human rights law.
Okay, so we go down the back and then we come up the front. We've got plenty of time. Yep.
Paul, thank you for a very generous presentation. It's a challenging one. One of the questions I have posed to you, but one that comes to mind that's rather interesting is, in your experience of recent rules of rights both locally and overseas, what are some possible unintentional byproducts of these rules of rights that you might have detected?
Could you just give a bit more clarity? When you say unintended byproducts, you mean?
Things that weren't intended. Mm. Consequences that weren't intended.
Well, maybe it's restricted freedom of expression rather than enhancement, I guess.
Okay. Well, I'm not sure if it... well, one thing I'll say, certainly, that I didn't expect. I expected that on day one, you might have lawyers in the courts identifying rights. And in fact, Margaret Stone of the Federal Court, who's on the ACT Court of Appeal, tells quite a nice story how on the very first day the ACT legislation came into force, there was a challenge to the Gungahlin Drive extension, which is a very ugly road in Canberra, on environmental grounds. And she tells a nice story how, you know, that one of the protesters who were representing themselves stood up and said, you know, Your Honour, the Human Rights Act. And she said, yes, and what about it? And they sort of said, just like the castle, you know, it's the vibe, it's the vibe. And she was very dismissive of this sort of thing. But I think, I suppose I did expect arguments to be made much more consistently in courts. And I've been very surprised that the Canberra legal community, the ACT legal community, has really not taken it up at all. And in fact, it tends to be the judges, when you look at the transcripts, saying, you know, dear barrister, is there a human rights point here? Please inform me on this. So that's one issue. And I suppose another thing, certainly I think it's been a shock for some public servants. I'm married to an ACT public servant, and he's an epidemiologist in the medical area, and one of the things that they planned to do was to use children to go and purchase cigarettes and tobacco products, and then as a way of seeing whether the prohibition on selling tobacco products to children was actually, you know, being enforced or not. And I think department was very shocked when it was told, well, there could be some human rights implications here about using underage children to entrap tobacco merchants. So I think some public servants have been not all, let me say, have welcomed it with open arms, because they have felt in some ways that their wings have been clipped. Public servants who have very, particularly those who have very broad discretionary powers, I think have sometimes been slightly alarmed to think that they would have to actually think about the human rights implications. Those are two things. I think also the government, even though our Chief Minister John Stanhope is very keen on human rights, I think that sometimes perhaps some of his ministers have also been slightly discomforted when they've been told, you know, this action or that action is much more difficult now because of human rights questions. But those are the... I can't think of... it may be from the tone of your question that you were looking for something that's really backfired or had a negative...
Evolution, the process of evolution sometimes.
Yes. Yes, yeah. Yes, and I can't... Maybe it's not been... been long enough, but I can't think of anyone's there. Of course, Victoria is going to be very interesting, the development of the Victorian Charter of Rights and Responsibilities, because they're a much, much larger jurisdiction. And we only have a year's worth of practice so far, and I can't think of a really good example of an unintended consequence off the top of my head.
Pushing up the back. Come up here.
Sorry.
Yes, well, in both the case of the ACT and Victoria, there were quite lengthy consultations. And you may be aware that in WA, there was a consultation led by Fred Cheney last year. And in Tasmania, there's also been a consultation. It's quite interesting in Australia. So four states and territories have done this of differing periods. I think the Victorian consultation received, if I remember correctly, over 1,000 submissions. So there was, they really got a lot of people. And... in the ACT, we were perhaps a bit more conservative. We really basically stuck to the rights set out in the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, because the powers of the territories to legislate are more limited than those of the states under the Constitution. What's interesting is that out of the WA consultation, for example, they published a very, very interesting report, and... they recommended that there be rights specifically designed to deal with the rights of Indigenous peoples, the rights, environmental rights, and the rights to health and to education. So their proposals were actually quite far in advance of those as echoed in the ACT and Victorian ones. So one would hope, and indeed that's what the Commonwealth Attorney General, Robert McClelland, has promised. And I think I noticed somewhere he's put aside $1 or $2 million to do his consultations. So presumably they're going to be relatively far-reaching consultations with the Australian community about what are the rights that are essential to us. And perhaps we don't need to stick to the international ones. We could devise our own.
There's a question here.
I was just wondering what your view is on the inclusion of ancestral rights in a statutory bill of rights, and whether you think that if you were to include such rights, your argument as to the compatibility between judicial relationship and a democracy would actually be less strong in that context, because you are dealing with rights that in fact have a lot of budgetary implications and policy, and perhaps would impede on policy making.
What rights did you refer to?
The rights set out in the this is international lawyers' acronyms, the International Covenant on Economic, Social and Cultural Rights. So rights such as the right to health, the right to education, the right to the highest attainable standard of living, and so on. Yeah, look, my own view, I should say that both the ACT and the Victorian Bills of Rights contain provisions in them for a review of the legislation after a particular period of time to see whether the rights were adequate or updated. And this isn't the issue that's about to be raised in the ACT, because we're almost up to our five-year review that was mandated through the legislation. And the Chief Minister has said in a number of speeches that he is interested in examining the issue, should we include economic, social and cultural rights. In the United Kingdom, of course, there is one economic, social and cultural right. That's the right to education, protected under the UK legislation. My own view is that it's quite wrong to separate out civil and political rights on the one hand and economic, social and cultural rights on the other. I think that's quite a false distinction. And the only reason we have two covenants is because the Cold War intervened during the drafting, and there was the Universal Declaration on Human Rights, for example, contains both civil and political rights and economic, social and cultural rights. So I'm a person who supports... I don't think that there we can see the two sets of rights as different qualitatively at all. I think that if... sure, you have to spend money to protect economic, social and cultural rights, but if you take civil and political rights seriously, you also have to spend money to do so. So I think the distinction that's often drawn, borrowing from Isaiah Berlin, that civil and political rights are negative rights and economic, social and cultural rights are positive rights, I don't really buy that distinction. So I think for myself, think that it's valuable to include both sets of rights. I also think, and you may well know this yourself, that if we look at the work of the South African Constitutional Court, its interpretation of economic, social and cultural rights, we can see a very interesting jurisprudence emerging there, where the South African Constitutional Court has said, look, it's not the role of courts to second-guess policy prescriptions at all. They simply won't buy into that. But they say, we can certainly judge actions and say if they're in violation of a particular right. So they have refused to take the step of, you know, second-guessing the legislature. So I think those fears about the justiciability of economic, social and cultural rights are somewhat overstated. And I don't think it would be a problem in a dialogue model of Bill of Rights.
Professor, thank you very much. I don't need to be persuaded by any of your arguments. I used to live in Canberra.
Oh, it's the air we breathe or something.
My background is in friendly law and to a lesser extent in politics. So I don't have indeed any persuasion that why the politicians are against the Bill of Rights, because they would lose their power. If I can pronounce his name, but I won't even try a second.
John has discussed.
I have great difficulty with it. And also I can understand the opposition of the churches too, because they too would lose their power. That's indicating my bias, of course. But the underlying reason behind the need for a Bill of Rights, in my opinion, is the equality of rights, basically putting it in its simplest form, of course. One of my... One of my remaining interests until fairly recently was the issue of voluntary euthanasia. And about 11 years ago, Tim and Andrews introduced a private members bill into the federal parliament, which took away the power of the territories using Section 120 of the Constitution to ever make such a law. Now, the people who live in New South Wales, they can make such a law. It's a controversial subject. Perhaps it's not a good example to give, because it is controversial, and not everyone supports it. But a free vote of the federal parliament decided, in an example, that the tyranny of the majority, if you like. It was an example of the tyranny of the majority. I'll wind it up. Basically, took away to the people of the Northern Territory, the people of Norfolk Island, and the people of the ACT could never, ever, while that law remains intact, make such a law. Whereas the people of New South Wales, the people of Victoria, the people of South Australia and so forth, can make such a law. Now that's a denial of human rights.
I think so, we do have one speaker tonight, and I think that's enough. Hillary, quick response.
I just say, of course, that some of the cases, just on the topic of voluntary euthanasia, I mean, there have been cases under the United Kingdom Human Rights Act raising those issues, and it's, in a way, I suppose, really to come in your last point, that a Bill of Rights might have sort of solved some of these questions, at least on the substantive issue. The European Court of Human Rights has been very doubtful about whether euthanasia is consistent with the right to life. So I just sort of point out that there's deep disagreement. It's a very, very controversial topic. So it's an example of human rights, in some people's view, proponents of or supporters of euthanasia would probably be quite disappointed in the human rights response that at least has come from the leading courts on that case. But I agree with you as a proud Territorian on the issue of 122. Yeah. Well, yes, because it's often said, well, if you have very nice anti-discrimination statutes on race, sex, what's the value of human rights? And I guess the point is that human rights guarantees go considerably further. So just take the woman, the case I gave from the United Kingdom, the woman who was initially denied the right to be able to share a bed with a husband. There would be no problem under discrimination laws if the authority could show we treat everybody who needs a special bed the same way. If we give everybody a single bed and insist on it, there's not a problem because we're just treating like cases alike. So discrimination laws, just to use that case, don't get at the real problem, which is this woman saying, I'm not interested in the fact that I'm being discriminated against compared to other people who are in my situation. I'm interested in my human right to a family life and to privacy. So I think that human rights are, they deal with issues far beyond the discrimination realm. Freedom of speech often won't be a discrimination issue. There is certainly a point at which there is some intersection, but human rights generally as a category are much, much broader. And it's often said by administrative lawyers, well, look, administrative law gives you everything you need. Why do you worry about human rights as well? And it seems to me that, again, administrative law is quite a limited regime with respect to human rights. And if you just take this court case right here in Sydney that got a lot of publicity last week about the so-called annoyance provisions. So that really was decided on the basis of an administrative law technique, saying the law was simply too broad, the principle of legality. It didn't actually deal with human rights issues involved. Indeed, it implied that a well-worded law having the same effect could have got up and there would have been no problem. So that's why I think human rights guarantees offer much, much broader. They reach a broader range of instances and aren't fettered in the same way as administrative and discrimination law.
You've got ample time, you've got to be brief. Okay.
I'm always brief. A few years ago in Victoria, two Protestant ministers were taken to court and fined for conducting a seminar in which they criticised or examined, I don't know how serious the criticism was, they examined the Koran. And they were found, I don't know under what law or whether it's under human rights,
racial vilification.
Now, I believe that you could not have had the Reformation under those conditions. And unfortunately, I believe there's now a canvassing of votes in the United Nations to make criticising other people's or other religions illegal or part of denial of human rights. And I feel it's very important that you have intellectual freedom to criticise the Roman Catholics, the Protestants, or anybody.
Okay.
Yeah, agreed. And I should just say, I think that's the, is that the Catch the Fires ministry case, which was under, as I understand, the Victorian racial vilification legislation, not the charter. So I just want to make that point. And it seems to me that criticism of other religions is perfectly consistent with human rights. It's part of freedom of speech. However, there is, of course, a very nice distinction between when something actually turns into vilification. This is going to be something where minds probably differ. But cases like that, in the European Court of Human Rights, to take one established jurisdiction, have very much erred on the side of allowing the maximum amount of freedom of speech. So I don't see that in this context as a serious issue.
Was the appeal upheld, you know?
Somebody else may.
I think it's still in the system.
Is it? Yes, I don't know.
Many of these statutory bills of rights, for instance, the English one, conceived of as private rights defendable against the government politically. But there's currently sort of moves where various cases are seeking to ascertain, if you will, horizontally, by way of trying to get the court to assert your protect your rights that someone else is trying to infringe. And I was wondering whether you think this is a movement that we need to guard against, given, or whether it's not, and whether it changes the type of rights that are at issue, or whether human rights can be balanced against other people's human rights as opposed to just against government interference.
Can I come in there and just say, I think that's a good question on which to conclude on, so this will be your final response.
Okay. Well, I think that there is, as you know, there's sort of a lot of discussion about vertical effects of human rights and horizontal effects of human rights. Of course, you've got to remember that the driver of these modern bills of rights is an interpretation provision. So it basically says to courts, look, courts, when you have a piece of legislation, it can be the Fence Act, the Dog Act, the Family Law Act, the Anything Act, you must interpret that as far as possible to be consistent with human rights. And, of course, legislation, a lot of legislation governs relationships, not just government to people. It's going to, if you and I had a neighbourhood dispute and we both look at the Fence Act that divides our properties, and we're in a jurisdiction that had such legislation, presumably we would both be looking at that legislation. So, in a sense, these interpretive bills of rights, these statutory ones, already, because they're interested in legislation and interpreting it to be consistent with human rights, already have the beginning of a horizontal effect, if you like. And I don't see any way around that, because if you're going to say this applies to all legislation, not just the Tax Act and, you know, the and criminal statutes, which are more vertical, it's inevitably going to have that. And I, for one, welcome that. It seems to me just to be consistent. So I would want, if I'm in a jurisdiction that's committed to human rights interpretation, I would want it as much to apply to your and my dispute about, you know, how high the fence is, or if it's relevant there, as to whether the government can imprison me without allowing me to call witnesses.
Many thanks. Take a seat. As you will have noted, Professor Charlesworth's address caused a lot of interest, and we could have gone on for another half an hour, but we don't. But the paper will be published in the Sydney Papers, and the podcasts will be up on the Institute's podcast tomorrow. So I just want to be very brief and say this is a very important issue, obviously. It's great to have an excellent communicator like Hilary Charlesworth here to give her position on this. The Rudd Labor government's looking at the issue. The various Labor governments through the states and the territories are divided on this issue, so the matter will continue. It's important to us that we're as well informed as we possibly can be, and Professor Charlesworth's contribution tonight has very much contributed to that. So many thanks, and no doubt we'll see you here again in the future. Thank you.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.